Hello, I'm Ricky Ross. When I made my first fragile toeholds on the slippery surface of this music caper, I was keen to find the right advice. When I did find the correct people to give it, they invariably would have the same thought process. It usually started with, well, in Simple Minds' case, or Simple Minds always did this, or more likely, Simple Minds wouldn't have touched that with a barge pole. It proved to be the best counsel I ever got, where Simple Minds had been and how they'd got the attention of the music business without ever leaving their homeland was a constant memorandum and an inspiration for us new boys trying to get heard. The man who started all of that is still an inspiration, and he's been keeping his band relevant, as well as internationally massively successful, for 40 years. So, for the next hour, join me as I discuss the amazing career of Simple Minds with their imaginer-in-chief, Jim Kerr. In coats of many colours, red time and drop. Stabilo, temperature. So listen, I was thinking about something. I was thinking about, of all the people that I know in self-isolation, I was thinking it might kind of be suiting you. You're at home in your own company, aren't you?
You know, I am. I mean, I have spent, well, I'm very lucky because, you know, I wouldn't like anyone to think I'm a loner or that I didn't appreciate the company of others. I'm very lucky. I got great friends, great family. But since the early days of Simple Minds, whenever there's been a chance to go off on my own, I've relished that. Even on tour, in terms of being social, I'm not a drinker. Never been a drinker or a smoker or whatever. I love the company of people, but I do spend a lot of time on my own, and I guess I've never been bored in doing so. So as long as that's the case, you kind of, there's always things to do. I mean, I'm a reader, I'm a walker, all of those things. But I do love the company of people as well. I would hate to present it in the one way. I'm very much in the middle. But I remember for a period, Charlie and I lived in Ireland, and a bit like the Scots, perhaps even more so. You know, the Irish like a gab. They don't understand if you don't go down the pub and you don't do this and you don't do that. And they couldn't get it in their heads that, you know, Edge and Bono lived nearby and they would call me the mystery man. Bono says, he's like Buddha. We hear he's everywhere, but we never see him. Hopefully, right. He was talking about that and not my belly, but yeah, I think you've hit on something, Ricky.
One of the things I've been doing this week has been great, is just going back over your back catalogue, and it's a phenomenal back catalogue, because I find it's interesting when you go back and think, what was I thinking? You know what I mean? Do you do that? I mean, do you go back to seeing someone like Chelsea Girl and go, where was I? What was I thinking about? What were the songs I was kind of also thinking about?
Yeah, it's akin to looking at a photograph. You know, when you used to look at photographs when you're young or when you're a teenager, you would cringe or be embarrassed at the stuff you were wearing, or just a question. What was I thinking of? But then as you get older, well, I have, and I suspect you might have, you give yourself a break. You go, yeah, but, you know, that was the look, that was the style, and if you didn't look like that, then you wouldn't have been cool. Or from those early records, it's been long enough now to look back, and whenever I see pictures of me or the guys and the music we produced, although a second ago I was saying I maybe cringe about this and I cringe about that, In other ways, I don't. I just think, wow, you know, where did that creativity come from? Where did we get the gall to think that we could conjure up this thing that would impress us enough to think somebody else might like it as well?
Yeah.
And somebody else in the other side of the world might like it.
Yeah.
It's the good conceit, and I think you're nowhere without that. Yeah. I think, well, you'll be somewhere, but you're probably not going to get out your bedroom. And now the sound of time is passing fast, it's getting late, don't know if I can take much more. When you talk, I often wondered if I heard the word somewhere, someplace before. I got so nervous when I called and found that lately you had gone and changed your name.
When we started Deacon Blue in 85, 86, around about that time, and you're looking for a record deal, you're looking for it to get started, everyone that you would talk to, if you ask a big question about the music business, of what are you going to do, bro? Simple Minds. So Simple Minds did this. Well, Simple Minds did this. Well, Simple Minds, you know, you were kind of like the roadmap that had been there for Scottish bands who wanted to have some success, because you'd done a lot of the things for the first time. I mean, you set that idea that we don't go to London, you know, record companies come to us, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things that you'd done which made it easier for people to go. I was wondering, in terms of you guys, who were the people that you were thinking, God, they did it, they managed it, so we can?
I mean, I have to tell you the truth here. Albeit in doing that, I'll sound arrogant, and I really don't want to, but whether this was a view of Glasgow at the time, or whether this is a view of the south side of Glasgow, which to us, you know, crossing over the river there was like crossing the equator. Ricky, we had never met anyone that had written a song.
Right.
I had never spoken to anyone. There was no teacher, no method, no guru. Well, there was. His name was Bruce Finlay, and we happened on him later on. But there was nothing, and I say that. It's there was a desert, and then there was us. We grew out of the desert. It was a desert because punk changed everything. That's where timing played into our hand. Before punk, it was all centralised in London. There was no punk-enabled kids up and down the country. There was a liberation came with that, and it allowed things to be DIY, it allowed things to be regionalised. Mm. You could be in Liverpool, you could be in Manchester, you could be in Sheffield, you could start a band, or suddenly you believed you could start a band, you believed you could start a fashion label, you believed you could be a documentary maker. All of that seemed before that the gatekeepers were in London, and therefore you would have to go to London. And in doing that, it was tough to go to London. You know, you were skint, you couldn't get on, it was overwhelming, or if you didn't really know anyone there. So inevitably, a lot of good talent would go and, you know, end up disillusioned pretty soon, end up starving pretty soon. It's a bit of a joke thing, but I still maintain, had we not dallied with punk with this band called Johnny and the Self-Abusers, there's a chance that we could still be sitting in the pub today saying, well, one day we'll get up there and play, you know, because the thing about punk was there was this mad energy that kids just felt, we can give it a go.
Saints and sinners, money's good at Saints and sinners, sometimes though. Saints
Simple Minds were born out of this punk band called Johnny and the Self-Abusers that made one single and split up the day the single came out. Can't get more punk than that. Done the world a favour as well. But I remember the last gig. It is interesting, this, and we were standing waiting to go on. It was one of those, it was quite an edgy discotheque, as they used to call them, in Glasgow. And the DJ said, right, you're on after this, but it's okay because this record, it's a single, but it lasts for 10 minutes. I said, what are you talking about? He said, no, it's a 12-inch single. And I couldn't get my head around what a single was a single.
Yeah.
You know, was a 7-inch. He said, no, it's a 12-inch single and it's a 12-inch mix. And I didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But he put it on. And, you know, I used to, I did drink in those days. So between the Dutch courage and whatever else I was taking, this thing came out the speakers and I just thought, oh my God, what is that? I Feel Love, Donna Summer. This wailing voice, the rhythm and all that. I said to Charlie, how do we get a sound like that? He said, we need a synthesizer. And I said, who in Glasgow's got a synthesizer? He said, no one. Synthesizers up until then were, it was a big deal. Could you believe a week later Charlie's girlfriend comes in from work and says to Charlie, oh, da-da-da, my pal in work, her boyfriend's, it's a synth player. And Charlie said, what are you talking about? He's got a synth. No, he doesn't have a synth. No, he has a synth. Where does he play? Oh, he plays in this Chinese restaurant in Kilmarnock Road, and him and his brother's band, and he hates the band, but they let him play a few synth solos, and lo and behold, his name is Mick McNeil.
Right.
Charlie went to see him, and Mick came with his synth, and you know, just at that time, XTC magazine, there was bands that could play.
Mm.
And we wanted to be a band that could play and have keyboards and all of that. And they were still pretty thin on the ground then. So between our attitude and the first few songs we made, we'd play on a Sunday night and we built up a following.
Even at that early time, how quickly did you get a sense of we're going somewhere? I mean, was it just watching an audience grow? Was it because you weren't getting like main daytime radio play, were you?
No, our saving grace was, in fact, we were in a ton of debt. We were in a ton of debt because we had 3 or 4 records. We're starting to get good reviews and all of that. But if you remember back in those days, you couldn't have a hit until you were on Top of the Pops, and they wouldn't bend the rules. You needed songs to be in the top 30.
Yeah.
We had 3 songs that went, I think The American was number 35, Love Song was 33,
right.
Sweat and Bullet was 31. Our drummer left. He said, this isn't happening. It's never going to happen. Right back to the start, if you'd said to Charlie and I the first day, what do you want out of this? It's very, very simple. We would have said to you, I know this, because we didn't know anything about riches or fame or whatever, or money or nothing. We didn't know about that. We would have said, we want to be in a great live band and we want to take it around the world. And I have to say, 40 years later, that's still what we want to try and be.
Yeah.
But that's what we wanted. And we knew to do that, there was no shortcut. You had to play. And you had to get out and play. If there was only three men and a dog, or three women and a dog, or they went wild, and at the end of the night, you could convince yourself, well, it's a long way to go, but it is happening. We spent whatever money we had, because we were losing money. We scraped publishing. We would use it to finance tours of Germany and all that stuff. And then kind of we would get on a support with maybe Gary Newman or Peter Gabriel. That was a big, big deal. And start to get a bit of a name.
An album that fans of yours will love, and still you go back to, as Sons and Fascination, Sister Feelings. There are songs on these records, and again, you talked about it, they're not hits in the way that people talk about hits nowadays. A huge part of your repertoire. Love Song, Theme from Great Cities, which is a song I've seen you do live, an instrumental you do still, and maybe one of your most popular, The American. So these were kind of big stepping stones, weren't they, at that time for you as well?
It took Simple Minds quite a some time. I mean, when I look at your career, the first song I ever heard, you know, when you Rain Town and Born a Storm, it's fully formed. It's absolutely fully formed. It's just right there. Some bands, great bands, artists have that in their debut. It's just right there. Simple Minds wasn't like that. It took us some time, I think, to come out from under our influences. You could say, well, that's as much as we're still influenced by Bowie and art rock and Roxy and all that. There was enough of our own thing in it to say, that's a Simple Minds sound.
Yeah.
And I associate that period with starting to feel like that. The Simple Minds taste in music, I mean, that was Charlie Burchill's big brother was the sort of, he was a library to us. He had the record collection. He's where we heard everything from Motown to The Doors to Blood on the Tracks to Joni Mitchell, Alice Cooper. And we were never really stuck on one style. And even to this day, when people say to me Simple Minds, the sound of Simple Minds, of course I do know what they mean. But I could say, well, was it the, you know, is it the new romantic Simple Minds? Is it the shiny pop Simple Minds? Is it the Celtic Simple Minds of I mean, who would have thought we would have gone from I Travel to She Moved Through the Fair, Belfast Child? You can't really see the link, but I have to hand that. I have to hand almost everything to the guys, but I have to hand it to the guys. Not only to have an interest, a wide interest is one thing, great, but to be able to play, to be able to sort of carry it off and to be able to incorporate that expanse in your musical style, get away with it and do it well, it's well, all credit to them.
Listening to BBC Radio Scotland, it's Ricky Ross in conversation with Simple Minds singer and imaginer-in-chief Jim Kerr. The magnificent thing about a hit single is when it becomes a hit single, once it kind of tips over the edge, is you can't stop it, you can't bring it back, because once it's gone into that sort of public space, it will be there. Was that satisfying when that finally comes along?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it felt great. I mean, there was something about that year, 1982, where things moved early on. I thought something's changed here. Echo and the Bunnymen are on top of the Pops. The Associates are on top of the Pops. I mean, it's like, wow. And this great melodic music that was still, I mean, they were still on the cover of NME. There was an art about them. There was a intellectualness about all that. There was, you could love them on so many levels.
Yeah.
The great symbol of that was if you could be on the cover of the NME and the cover of Smash Hits. The bridge was there, and it felt exciting to be able to do that. And also, the encouragement you get from that is it's what we live for.
Well, I must say, I'm extremely pleased to introduce this next act. It's a band I've championed a lot on my radio show, and here they are making their Top of the Pops debut, Simple Minds.
Love takes our train. Summer breeze and brilliant light. Only love she sees. She controls our love. Love serves to a new life. Promised you a miracle. Belief is a beauty thing. Promises, promises.
I came to Glasgow around about the Christmas of 82, 83 to take up a teaching job. And I worked in the East End of Glasgow, and I hadn't been teaching before. I'd worked in youth work. So I was kind of, really, in a sense, I was kind of still a stranger in that world. And I was coming into work one morning, and out of the six-year common room in the school, they were playing at full volume, Someone Somewhere in Summertime. And
nice.
I was just moved. I was like, this is like the best thing that happened to me since I'd arrived in Glasgow.
Oh.
I was hearing this thing, and I was going, and I was so moved. And it was playing at full volume. And then this guy, who I'd never seen before, was like the local kind of teaching union guy, came in and started shouting at these kids to tell them to turn it down. I thought, I'm in the wrong job. I'm in the wrong job. I wanted to get in the common room and just rejoice, you know?
I'm thrilled to hear that. I'm not cool, you know. It's just thrilled to hear that. It's fantastic. And what a track. I think of that. Derek Forbes has bass on it. McNeil, the melodies. Charlie does that thing that just starts and you feel good. People say, how did you write that? I said, it felt like a spring morning, you know. It felt like summer was coming. There was sweetness to it, but there's also this longing to it as well. Mm. There's a joy, but there's kind of sadness. And when the music is that evocative, the words would kind of write themselves.
And then not long after that, I'm thinking about around about 1983, you're doing a gig in Dublin with U2, is that right?
Yeah.
I guess maybe the first time there was a lot of commonality between U2 and you and Big Country. And you perform a song that night in Dublin for the first time.
Yeah.
And it sort of goes, wow. And the song's called Waterfront. Is that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We rehearsed in London. We had a day, and Derek Forbes plugged in, and he had this, you know, rhythm, this... It was a blues thing he was playing, but the way he set it on the echo, it wasn't just blues. There was something else to it. And he also played this melody on a fretless, very flash. So he triggered that, and then he played this melody, which to me was very... Gaelic, very, very Celtic, almost sea shanty-ish, I don't know. And I remember saying to him, well, I said, listen to that, listen to the sound of that. It sounds like the engine of an ocean liner. A lot of water going on there.
Yeah.
And I said, we should do it, and I'll come up with some words, we'll do it at the sound check tomorrow. I said, we'll, instead of having an intro tape as we used to have then,
yeah,
we'll just go with this rhythm and the melody and the beat, and then we'll go into something. I'll either have words or I won't. And by the sound check, I did have the words. I wrote them on the plane going across, and it was even it was kind of chant. And so it was half baked, but we opened with it, and it went down a storm.
I wondered if it was a great thing about a band who have had that ambition to go across the world, to go various places. I don't know if you remember that beautiful film, The Warriors,
yeah,
where they go.
I do, yeah.
They fight all the way in New York.
Brilliant.
Just to get back to Coney Island. And when they get back to Coney Island, it's based on Jason and the Argonauts,
yeah,
isn't it? And they get back to Coney Island and go, wow, we fought all the way to get back for this.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a Warriors moment, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes you do have to go away to come back and appreciate. Mm. In fact, I think you always do, probably. Mm. The story was, we had travelled kind of non-stop for about 4 years, and then the night I came back, I went for a walk. It was a summer night, and I went for a walk, and I went down to where the BBC is now at the Clyde. And at that time, I mean, it was still pretty much beaten up. I mean, it was still, although the Garden Centre had happened, and the hype, and hype's important, you need hype to begin stuff, it was still the sad remnants of a Glasgow that had known great power and known great success, and then ended up on its knees as the industrial years went. And so you still had all this, it was like graveyards. But I remember walking around there that night. It was a spectacularly beautiful night. The river was just absolutely flowing. And I think there had been, it's getting biblical here, I think there had been a report in the newspaper I'd read that for the first time in a gazillion years, salmon had been spotted, right, in the Clyde. I don't think we were actually feeding the city yet, but
yeah,
it was almost like new life was coming. The pollution had kind of gone, and there were signs of new life, and I was thinking about that. That thing of coming back and saying, we go all this way searching, and sometimes you miss what's under your nose.
You're listening to BBC Radio Scotland, where it's Ricky Ross in conversation with Jim Kerr.
I got an after-school job working at the Apollo, Glasgow Apollo, for about a year and a half, which meant I got to see any band I wanted to see.
Yeah.
And,
is that your apprenticeship then, really, is it?
It kind of was. I didn't know. I didn't sit there thinking one day I'll be up there. Nothing like it. I just couldn't believe I was there. And I just knew that, for instance, Mott the Hoople, who were my band at the time, an unknown band called Queen opened for them. And as great as Mott were, I just knew that... good luck following Queen.
Really?
The front man and the whole thing, it was just like, it was insane. And I just knew that there would be bands where the music, you know, you had a good night and then there was bands that made you want to run home. You just, well, you made you want to run after the gig. You were just full of something. I remember a guy saying, it was, you want to go, you know, Wednesday night, you're working. I said, what is it? He says, it's Reggie music. I said, I said, Reggie music. He said, Bobby Marley. I knew, I didn't know anything, but I knew that I was seeing something of colossal proportions. I'm so jealous. I just knew.
I never saw Bob Marley. I just knew. That. Amazing.
There was lots of things happening. I don't know what that is, but I know this is just ultra, ultra special. I mean, I think, well, it started with Exodus.
Oh.
Which is like, I mean, it's like the walls are shaking.
Yeah.
I saw Bowie's matinee at Aladdin Sane, and the guy said it was amazing. The Greens had there was a staircase under the stage, and they said, come on, we've got to go and move these cases. And the set was just ending. And as we went down, the guy said, everybody stand down to the side. And Bowie and the Spiders, literally, it was a tiny corridor. The Hem, I touched the Hem. they walked past. And I didn't think, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that one day. But I did think, the world has changed. This is a world. The people do this thing. I've got to get involved in this somehow. And that's why I wanted to hang around with musicians and still do.
I wanted to talk about Don't Forget About Me. Obviously, hugely successful song on a soundtrack. It did have a number one in America, so you can never write that off. And you still play the song. But am I right in thinking there was a bit of you guys that really didn't want to do it? And I mean, it was a departure. It wasn't your song, and it was suggested to you and so on. But most people will listen to it and think, that's a Simple Minds song.
Well, first of all, you're right. We didn't want to do it because the way it was put to us really clumsily.
Right.
And you know, sometimes, especially when you, back in those days, when you would get an American record company guy that was maybe, I'm just saying, I love Americans. I love playing American. I love their whole thing. But there was a typical kind of American record company executive. And it was one of those guys who kind of said, right, you know, you're going to be happening, but you're going to do this for us. And we were like, hang on a minute. And then he said, well, there's this movie and there's a song. They really want you to do it. And we said, what do you mean? We don't do other people's songs. We do our songs, you know, and we've got this thing called Alive and Kicking here. Listen to it. And no, that'll be great. Do this for, you know. And it was kind of, we were also precious and we were nervous and we didn't understand it. And they sent us the movie and we didn't understand that either, because we don't have that thing here, that thing where you got to go into school on a Saturday if you've been naughty, you know. So we were very standoffish about it until we met the guy who wrote and produced it, Keith Forsey, who, it was one of these, we liked Keith better than we liked his song. And he came over and, you know, he said, look, I know you're not going to do it. Very clever. I know you're not going to do it, but I love the band and maybe we'll do something. I'm coming up there anyway. Can we spend some time, couple of days? And this little guy comes in and we just loved him. Just loved him. And he said, look, you know, this thing, the record company are really, don't you fancy just trying it and getting them off your back? And nothing happens, something happens. Yeah. And that was the background. None of us expected it to get the success that it did. Of course, when we set up the drums and plugged in, we were going to give it our all, because you don't know how not to give it your all, no matter what you do. That's what great bands do. They, yeah. Well, it's a sound check, you give it your all. If you don't, it's a bad habit. So you give it your all, and we're like, well, you know, it doesn't sound too bad, that. And we were kind of a bit, you know, we're a bit like, yeah, well, it's just that thing. But every week we're like, what number is it now? 35? Yeah. 16? Number 8? Number 1? False and start saying, no, we always loved it. So you get in this thing, you think, but hang on a minute, people like this and we're being churlish about it. You know, it kicked open the doors to another level, and you don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
The 80s is an interesting time because obviously there's like, there's a Live Aid, there's all of that stuff going on. And I remember the time when it was a big deal about what people do about South Africa. And obviously you had little Stephen singing about it, Special AKA singing about it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff in Parliament. How did you become aware of Nelson Mandela, aware of the apartheid story, to such an extent that you actually wanted to write a song about it, that you wanted to organise a day about it? Because you guys were pretty central to all of that. What happened first in all of that? I guess an awareness at some point?
All starts with growing up in Glasgow.
Right.
And particularly my dad. My dad was a bit of he was a great reader. My dad's a labourer. He's a brickies labourer. And he was very much a brickies labourer. But at a certain point, he stopped drinking. And he was always a reader, but reading more. And he kept saying it to us. And he was, you know, he was a socialist on the red side of things and on the right side of things. And I remember that, and it makes me proud now, because it was years before Mandela became the kind of cause celeb. Glasgow, the city council of Glasgow, had already given Nelson Mandela the so-called freedom of the city. I think it was the first city in the world. I remember before that, even my granddad was in South Africa during when he was in the army, and I remember him telling us, when we were wee, oh, what an amazing country, that a beautiful country. Such a shame. And he would detail the situation, you know, people aren't allowed to vote, people aren't allowed. So when you're wee, that gets in.
Yeah.
Just as simple minds were starting to go through the kind of into the big league, people were asking you to get involved in things and the human rights thing. And we were keen, you know, why? Of course, we were young, idealistic, if we could lend a voice. It wasn't so much that we thought we'd the answers or sometimes you maybe came across you were trying too hard or whatever. But my dad and I went on a trip to Africa. And we were in Gambia, a winter's holiday. But we went on a day trip to Senegal, and if I've got this right, I can't remember the name, but there's a village there where the ancestors of Alex Haley, who wrote Roots, came from. And very few times I see tears in my dad's eyes, I have to say, but he had them that day, and I think I did too. They still have the fort there where the slaves, as they were brought from the land, they took them to the coast, and then they put them into these forts on the coast in the Gambia before they went through the hole in the wall onto the ships. And still had the irons on the walls, and we were profoundly... You knew all this stuff, but when you actually, you can touch the walls. And I think I was so kind of taken by that. And when I came back, it's still the idea of apartheid, dehumanization, all of that. I think around about that time, Jerry Damos got in touch, and he had this idea on the back of Live Aid. That's the way to go. You want to get attention, you put on a big global concert. He needed a band. He needed a big band. He said, if I get you, Dire Straits said they'll do it if Simple Minds do it. And we said, well, we're in. But we got a lot more profile out of it than we should have. Only because... I'm glad we got this wrong. I'm sure Jerry said to us... Because I think I'd said, yeah, but, you know, a lot of people turn up at those things and they're not really into it. They just get the profile. And he said, no, everyone's going to have to write a song. Everyone's going to have to state their case. And I thought, that's great. You know, that's... Because then you get this whole, art thing as well. It's not just a big, shiny pop concert. But anyway, I don't know what happened to everyone else's songs, but we did write a song, and it became a kind of a flagship for it.
It was 25 years to take that man away. Now the freedom moves in closer every day. Wipe the tears down from your saddened eyes. They say Mandela's free, so step outside. Oh, Mandela Day. Ooh, Mandela's free. It was 25 years ago this very day. Behind the walls all through night and day.
Did it all come full circle? Did you meet Mandela?
We did, yes, on two or three occasions. And the last time we saw him, we went into this room. There was just tons of people there all queuing up, And, the guy looked tired. Charlie and I said, let's leave. It's the last thing he needs, said everybody, And as we're going out, one of his family approached, I think one of the organisers had said, oh, this is the guys that wrote that song and all this. I mean, by this time, the Spice Girls were around them and all that. We were sort of like, let's get out of here. And they said, no, hang on a minute. So Charlie and I went into this room, and he sort of stopped what he was doing. And he came in and he said, well, from Scotland, yes. Tell me about the salmon fishing. We're like, what? He said, yeah, you have the best salmon fishing in Scotland. Where will you take me? It's like, I got baggy minnows in the Queen's Park, mate. And I think he mentioned the boxing as well. I think he mentioned Benny Lynch, believe it or not.
Really?
I mean, he was just, with us, he was this wily old fox. There was nothing sanctimonious or anything. He was like, in fact, I also laughed. He said to me, do you know Whitney Houston? Do you know Whitney Houston? I said, no. He said, oh, she's a fine looking woman, isn't she? I said, yeah. For all he was and all the greatness he was a guy, just a guy. And that's what was immense.
You're listening to BBC Radio Scotland's Ricky Ross here in conversation with Simple Minds' very own Jim Kerr.
When my love said to me, meet me down by the gallows tree, for it's sad news I bring, about this old town and all that it's suffering. Some say troubles abound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast chant sings again.
When you bring in that sort of Irish element to it all, did people kind of like the fact that you'd brought their story and obviously tapped into the folk tradition as well? Did people respond to that from both sides of that divide?
Looking on it now, you got to take it on the chin when you take on the big issues.
Yeah.
You hope that what you're trying to do or what you're trying to put across, if it's a cry for peace or if it's something that comes through, but there'll always be somebody thinking you're getting too big for your boots, or how can you come up with something as trite as that? Well, of course it's trite. It's the last for 4 minutes. You're talking about, 200 years of history or something. Of course you're going to whittle it down to a few lines that you hope will tug the emotional strings. There was a point where with that song, we did it because it was in us.
Mm.
And then at a certain point, you do think, well, actually, maybe that was a bit overly ambitious or mawkish or something like that. But I'd gladly take it on the chin for daring to wish that one day peace would come. Jeez, oh.
Yeah.
What's so funny about peace, love and understanding, Ricky?
Exactly.
And of course, we were seeing it in a long line. I would never have heard of Stephen Biko, probably, if it hadn't been for Peter Gabriel.
Mm.
I just felt as a writer, I imagined, what I think, looking back? At the time in my life, I think I was experiencing some pain for the first time. I was going through a divorce and I was a father and I didn't know where it all went. And I think rather than write songs about that and verge into a kind of self-pity, I think I just tried to get lost in the big themes, the themes of the day.
Come back.
A song like Belfast Shell, when I think of it now, I mean, we just recently started playing it again, whereas we hadn't for a long time, because I thought peace isn't Belfast, it's come, so why go on and on about it? And then I thought, no, it's more than Belfast, because although we say it's the same in South Africa, apartheid doesn't exist anymore there and stuff, yeah, but racism still exists in the world. War still exists in the world. Mm. Places where human rights are not allowed still got, the geography changes. So the song can still have a resonance in a larger sense than it was initially written.
One day we'll return here when the Belfast chant sings again.
That's, sort of brings us full circle in the sense that you and Charlie, essentially, Simple Minds, have done something which is to keep this idea, this dream alive, to reinvent it and do it. Now, you talk about, songs going in and out of the set. It's a different landscape. Music has changed.
Mm.
The way people consume music has changed.
Mm.
But there you are. Right as we speak now, you're bang slap in the middle of a world tour. You've been stopped, okay?
Mm.
But, you're still due to go to all these places, come back to Scotland, come back to the UK. Then you did this amazing thing where you kind of, and I saw you do this acoustic kind of show. It was one of my favourite Simple Minds show. You did it at the concert hall. And again, reinventing the kind of songs. Then you do an album where you essentially cover yourselves in an acoustic way.
Well, I really enjoyed that acoustic thing that we did, where you quite rightly say we went through our catalogue and picked out the bigger songs and stripped them down. We had put off doing that for decades. I think we first did that in early 90s, where we did a couple of radio sessions in the States and we stripped down a couple of songs. It was just Charlie and I, and it went good. And everyone around us said, you should do it, record company. Mm. And we said, no, you know, doing it for a couple of songs is one thing, but, you know, yeah, doing it as a whole thing, I don't think so. And, you know, because there's a bombast to Simple Minds music, and a lot of the stuff is so layered that we just didn't feel confident. I made a mistake early on by calling up Bongos on the Beach, and I said, I'm not doing that Bongos on the Beach thing. That's not us. And I think, having said that, we couldn't quite get over it until, and this is where the Tory Glenn side comes out. This very wealthy guy in Switzerland got in touch, and he was doing this little acoustic festival, and he just wouldn't take no for an answer. And the fee kept going up and up and up and up and up until there was a point. I said, you know, see that Bongos on the Beach thing? Maybe it could be Bongos in the Snow. If it's rubbish, we're halfway up a mountain, nobody will see us. Yeah. Of course, I forgot everybody's got cameras and all that. Nobody will see us. We're up a mountain. We can drown our sorrows if it's a disaster. And if it's any good, maybe there's something in this. So we did the gig, and it was great. Shalom, shalom. It was amazing to go back to songs that we'd written when we were kids and be surprised that they were as well put together as they were, because we didn't think that at the time.
I'm just wondering now, finally, it's going to be best part of a year, I guess. What are you going to do? How are you going to creatively see that through?
Well, we had started, we were about halfway through the recording of what will be our next album prior to the tour, because we kind of do that. We put about six tracks, leave them for the year, come back to them, hopefully still like them, see what's needed, and then say, all right, how do we finish this thing off? So Charlie was a bit like you and I today, talking. Charlie was sending me MP3s yesterday. We're going through arrangement on a new song. So the writing goes on. Like every man and his dog just now, I'm writing my memoirs, Ricky, you know, quill in hand. Well, I am really. I mean, what will happen, or whatever, memoirs, whatever you would call it. There's a story there, and if I don't tell it, someone else will tell it.
Yes.
And I think I want it to be inspiring. I want it to be funny. I want it to pathos. I want to get all that stuff. Sounds great, except I'm not a writer. So I'll have to learn to be one. I'm not a singer either. But I'll throw myself into that in the meantime.
But you're a great, great storyteller, so it will be great, because it's one of the joys of spending time with you, is to hear your stories.
Well, I love people's stories. I love people's stories.
This has been such a pleasure. It's a shame that we're not in the same room, but we're round the corner from each other and we're enjoying the conversation. And Jim Kerr, as one songwriter to another, thank you so much.
No, Ricky, it's my pleasure. I love what you do on stage. I love your band. I hope we can do some work together.
Well, thank you, sir.